He wasn't just a DJ. He was a movement, a menace, a mouthpiece for the silenced. From the zinc-roofed streets of Portmore to global dancehall supremacy, a Digipalmer, known to the world as Vibes Cartel, built an empire out of defiance. But when his voice became too powerful, they caged the man and tried to erase the myth. Still, from behind prison walls, the music never stopped. This is the story of lyrical warfare, political fear, and a cultural rebellion that couldn't be silenced. This is the story of Vibes Cartel. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. In the heart of Waterford, Portmore, where zinc fences hum with the echo of old dancehall rhythms and the sea breeze carries both salt and secrets, a boy was born who would one day shake the foundations of Jamaican culture. His name was Adija Azeem Palmer, but long before the world called him Vibes Cartel, he was just Addy, a quiet, razor-sharp youth growing up in a world pulsing with rhythm and rage. The 1970s and 80s shaped Waterford into a breeding ground for raw, unfiltered expression. The neighborhood was a grid of cinder blocks and survival, tight corners, big voices, and bigger dreams. Poverty wasn't a condition, it was an atmosphere. But so was creativity. Like many inner-city communities across the Caribbean, Portmore was where sound systems grew like roots, and storytelling was an unspoken code of honor. Every wall was a canvas. Every corner, a potential stage. Adija's household was strict but loving. His mother, Teresa Palmer, a Christian schoolteacher, pushed him toward discipline, academics, and books. His father, Norris, a businessman, died when Adija was still young, leaving a silence in the home that music would soon try to fill. Even as a child, he consumed language like fire, reading voraciously, often far beyond his age group. Shakespeare, Machiavelli, ancient scriptures. This wasn't the usual fare for a youth in the ghetto, but Adija wasn't usual. School teachers would later recall him as both disruptive and gifted. Restless with traditional learning, yet acutely aware of the power of language. His notebooks weren't just filled with schoolwork, they were coded archives of rhymes, metaphors, and diss lines long before he had an audience. At Calabar High School, then later at Kingston's Tutorial College, his formal education was inconsistent, but his creative education was constant. In these early years, Jamaica itself was in flux. The violence between political factions, the rise of Don culture, and the social disenfranchisement of urban youth created both chaos and clarity for young minds. For Adija, it became clear that survival required more than muscle. It required message. He found his first musical refuge in the streets, where neighborhood DJs clashed not with fists, but with bars. Inspired by dancehall pioneers like Papa San, Ninja Man, and Buju Banton, he adopted the name Adi Banton, in homage to Buju. He was just 11 when he began experimenting with recording his voice. With borrowed time in makeshift studios and the guidance of older soundmen, the boy started sharpening his lyrical blade. In 1993, at the age of 17, Adija made his first real push into the music industry by joining the group Vibes Cartel, a trio that included two of his cousins. The group wouldn't last, but the name would. Vibes Cartel, now spelled with a K, became his moniker going forward. And with it, he carried the sonic DNA of Waterford, injected with something new, a ruthless intellect and an unapologetic command of the English language. His breakthrough track, Love Fat Woman, produced by One Heart, gave a glimpse into his unorthodox appeal, crude, catchy, clever. But mainstream success was still far off. For much of the mid-90s, Cartel was in the trenches, writing for more established artists like Bounty Killer and honing his craft behind the scenes. It was through this mentorship that his transformation began. But before Gaza, before the tattoos, the bleaching, and the incarceration, before he became a household name and a government target, Cartel was just a boy scribbling verses in the shadows of Waterford, hungry to be heard. The shadow was long, but the sound, his sound, was longer. Because even in a place where many voices go unheard, Vibes Cartel was born not just to speak, but to echo. If Waterford gave birth to Adija Palmer, then the streets of Kingston's dancehall scene baptized him into immortality. But even gods need gatekeepers, and for Cartel, that gatekeeper was the warlord himself, Bounty Killer. By the late 1990s, dancehall was entering a new era. The days of raw one-rhythm sound clashes were evolving into more refined studio dominance. To survive, you needed more than lyrics. You needed lineage. In Jamaica, few names carried the weight of Rodney Basil Price, aka Bounty Killer. A giant in both stature and status, Bounty had already minted stars like Elephant Man, Movado, and Busy Signal. His camp, the Alliance, was feared, respected, and positioned like a dancehall army. And it was into this empire that Vibe's Cartel would soon be drafted. The connection began through the pen. Cartel, still relatively unknown, had been ghostwriting for established artists in the late 90s. His lyrical prowess had become an open secret among producers. His punchlines were surgical, his metaphors relentless. It wasn't long before Bounty Killer took notice. Impressed by Cartel's razor-sharp writing, Killer invited him to join the Alliance, a move that would elevate Cartel from ghetto prodigy to mainstream disruptor. It was a mentorship that was both creative and military. Bounty didn't just teach Cartel how to rhyme. He taught him how to control a stage, command a rhythm, and weaponize lyrics like bullets. Under Bounty's watchful eye, Cartel refined his timing, delivery, and aggression. He studied sound clashes the way a chess master studies his opponent. He wasn't just making music, he was planning warfare. By 2002, the breakthrough came. Cartel's performance at Sting, the infamous end-of-year clash event in Jamaica, was electric. Going toe-to-toe with Ninja Man in a lyrical duel that nearly turned violent, Cartel emerged bloodied but crowned. His boldness stunned the crowd. His lyricism burned through the speakers. He was no longer just Addy from Portmore. He was Cartel the Threat. From there, the hits began to rain. Gun Clown, New Millennium, Sweet to the Belly. He was witty, dirty, violent, poetic, often all in the same verse. And unlike many of his peers, he brought a scholarly command of language into street dialect. He didn't just speak patois. He bent it, broke it, and rebuilt it into a new linguistic arsenal. But the Alliance wasn't built to hold two warlords. As Cartel's fame grew, so did his ambitions. He wanted his own camp, his own movement, his own empire. Tensions with Bounty Killer began to simmer. Creative disagreements turned into public spats. Interviews hinted at betrayal. Cartel's boldness, once nurtured by Killer, now threatened to eclipse him. By 2006, the split was official. Cartel left the Alliance and declared his own republic, Portmore Empire. And with it, he would usher in one of the most divisive eras in Jamaican music history, the birth of Gaza. But it was Bounty Killer who handed him the sword. What followed wasn't a student rebelling against his master. It was a monster that Bounty had unknowingly helped create. Now free, now fearless, and ready to remake dancehall in his own image. Cartel had entered the industry with ink-stained notebooks. Now, he held a mic like a machete, and he wasn't just coming for crowns. He was coming for control. Power changes everything. It shifts allegiances, redraws maps, and in dancehall, it starts wars. When Vibe's Cartel broke away from Bounty Killer and declared the formation of his own camp, Portmore Empire, the move wasn't just musical. It was revolutionary. Cartel wasn't building a crew. He was building a nation. And he would name it Gaza, after the embattled region in the Middle East, a name heavy with defiance, resistance, and war. The Gaza movement began as a musical stronghold, but quickly transformed into a cultural identity for Jamaica's disenfranchised youth. Based in Portmore, Cartel's new empire was militant, proud, and unfiltered. Its anthem wasn't just Cartel's lyrics. It was his attitude, raw, unapologetic, and in direct conflict with societal norms. Gaza wasn't just about music. It was about ownership, of sound, of image, of self. But every empire breeds an opposition. And from the uptown hills of Cassava Peace rose Movado, the new prince of dancehall and Cartel's former Alliance comrade. Movado formed his own camp, Gully Side, and almost overnight, Jamaica became a battlefield. Gaza versus Gully. What had once been lyrical rivalry exploded into tribal allegiance. Young fans aligned themselves based on geography, style, and ideology. In schools, neighborhoods, even prisons, Gaza and Gully flags flew. The feud infiltrated not just the charts, but the streets. Clashes turned physical. Police got involved. Politicians voiced concern. But to Cartel, the feud wasn't reckless, it was strategic. Every diss track, every public insult, every clash was fuel. His name dominated headlines. His music dominated airwaves. He released a relentless stream of tracks like Kill Dem All, Gaza Commandments, and Life We Living. His verses were weaponized poetry, targeting Movado, the government, and anyone who dared question his authority. It was during this period that Cartel's persona began to shift from artist to architect. He was building a legacy, not just through his own catalog, but through the stars he developed. Under Portmore Empire, Cartel mentored a young talent named Popcon, whose high-pitched voice and infectious hooks would become global staples. Other protégés like Gaza Slim and Tommy Lee Sparta followed, creating a powerful musical syndicate. But with every rising verse came rising controversy. Cartel's skin tone began to lighten, the result of deliberate skin bleaching, which he justified unapologetically. He wore tattoos of skulls, crosses, dollar signs. His image was as carefully curated as his lyrics. Critics accused him of promoting violence, sexual deviance, and moral decay. Cartel responded with more music and more dominance. Even the broadcasting authorities couldn't control him. When explicit lyrics were banned from airplay, Cartel adapted, crafting clean radio versions while fans sought out the uncut versions in the dance hall underground. He was always one step ahead, a master of subversion. But the pressure was building. Behind the scenes, tensions with law enforcement, cultural watchdogs, and political figures intensified. Accusations of gang involvement, influence over youth violence, and corruption of national morals made Cartel a marked man. He wasn't just popular. He was powerful. Too powerful. And in a society already terrified of what it couldn't control, Cartel was becoming the most dangerous thing of all. An artist with an army. By 2009, Vibes Cartel wasn't just dominating dancehall, he had become it. From every corner shop radio to every street dance in Spanish Town, his voice boomed like a prophet of the people. But to the establishment, he sounded more like a siren, a warning of social collapse. The Jamaican Broadcasting Commission labeled his lyrics corrosive. Politicians accused him of poisoning youth morality. Church leaders called him a spiritual threat. The police watched him not like an entertainer, but like a suspect. Yet Cartel remained unmoved, even defiant. Me na beg na friend, he often declared in interviews. That phrase wasn't just attitude, it was doctrine. Cartel reveled in controversy, feeding it like a fire. His songs during this era weren't simply entertainment. They were grenades, explosive, divisive, unforgettable. He blurred the line between art and reality, pleasure and provocation. Tracks like Rampin' Shop, with Spice, shocked the airwaves with its raw sexuality and undeniable chemistry. Clark's sparked a national obsession with the British footwear brand, selling out stores island-wide and proving he could weaponize even fashion for dominance. The term lyrical terrorist began circulating in local tabloids. What was meant as condemnation became, for Cartel, a badge of honor. He wore it publicly, repeatedly, and in doing so, rebranded himself as the most feared man with a microphone. He spoke about sex without shame, violence without apology, bleaching without regret. In interviews, he was cool, articulate, and borderline arrogant, a man clearly aware of his influence and unafraid to double down on it. His bleaching cream line, cake soap, sold in markets like contraband. His TV appearances became verbal shootouts. His hairstyle changed as often as his flow, mohawks, braids, even combovers. Every look, every lyric, every move was both a performance and a provocation. Yet beneath the public bravado, the walls were quietly closing in. Behind the scenes, the Jamaica Constabulary Force had placed Cartel under intense surveillance. His Gaza movement was being linked to a string of violent incidents across Kingston and Portmore. Although no hard evidence tied him directly to any crime, the perception, driven by media, law enforcement, and political rhetoric, was that Cartel wasn't just making music. He was mobilizing rebellion. In 2010, things reached a boiling point. A leaked police report accused Cartel of being the de facto leader of a criminal organization. The media ran with it. The government grew more vocal in its condemnation. Sponsors dropped him. Shows were canceled. And yet, his fan base only grew larger. At Sting 2010, Cartel appeared in all white, like a sacrificial figure standing before a crucifixion. He performed with rage and precision, taunting the system with every bar. The crowd roared in ecstasy. Outside the venue, police prepared dossiers. Within months, Cartel would be arrested, and dancehall would never be the same again. But at this height, the absolute pinnacle of his musical career, one thing was crystal clear. Vibes Cartel wasn't just an artist anymore. He was a walking indictment of Jamaica's deepest contradictions. A poor youth who outthought the elites. A convicted voice who hadn't yet been convicted. And that terrified the system far more than his lyrics ever could. On September 29, 2011, the voice that had echoed across the Caribbean and beyond was silenced, not by rival DJs, not by fading relevance, but by a police operation. Vybz Kartel was arrested at a New Kingston hotel. The initial charge? Possession of marijuana. But within hours, it evolved into something darker. The Jamaica Constabulary Force unveiled a web of accusations that would dominate headlines, reshape dancehall's landscape, and plunge Jamaica into a legal and cultural storm. The murder of Clive Lizard Williams was the charge that stuck, a chilling tale of loyalty, betrayal, and brutality. Authorities alleged that Kartel and several associates had lured Williams to a house in Havendale, St. Andrew, after he failed to return two missing firearms. According to the prosecution, what followed was a savage beating that ended in death. Williams' body was never found. The case sparked immediate division. To Kartel's critics, it was proof that his lyrics weren't just metaphors. To his fans, it was a setup, a calculated move to destroy the man who had become too powerful to control through censorship alone. The trial wouldn't begin until late 2013, but by then, Kartel had already spent over 2 years behind bars. Still, remarkably, the music never stopped. Despite being locked away, Kartel released a steady stream of new material, over 50 tracks during his pretrial detention. Songs like School, Convertible, and Business flooded dance halls and airwaves, leading many to wonder, was Kartel recording music in jail? Authorities denied it. Fans didn't care. Meanwhile, the prosecution built its case on shaky ground, but with overwhelming digital evidence. The Crown's primary tools were text messages, BBM chats, and voice recordings allegedly from Kartel's BlackBerry. One transcript appeared to show Kartel confessing. "Me chop up de boy Lizard fine fine." The voice, they argued, was unmistakably his. But defense lawyers pointed out multiple red flags. Chain of custody issues with the phones. Timestamps on messages that didn't align. Possible tampering and corruption. The defense even claimed some of the messages were fabricated. Still, the prosecution's narrative was gripping, and the court proceedings had the public hooked. It was the longest criminal trial in Jamaican history. 65 days of witness testimonies, expert analyses, and relentless media scrutiny. Outside the courtroom, fans rallied in protest. Graffiti appeared across Kingston reading, "Free World Boss." Inside, Kartel remained composed, defiant, and sharply dressed, suits, sunglasses, sometimes even smiling. He knew the cameras were watching. This was no longer just a trial. It was a televised cultural reckoning. On March 13, 2014, the verdict came down. Guilty. Vybz Kartel, along with three co-accused, was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison, with eligibility for parole after 35 years. The courtroom erupted. Tears. Screams. Applause from some, rage from others. For many Jamaicans, it wasn't just Kartel on trial, it was the system itself. What followed was equally surreal. Kartel, now a convicted murderer, continued to dominate the charts. His 2016 album, King of the Dancehall, debuted at number 2 on the Billboard Reggae Albums chart. Songs like Fever became global hits, streamed millions of times across platforms, played in clubs from Kingston to London. Incarcerated, Kartel became more influential than ever. Fans saw him as a martyr. His lyrics took on new weight. Conspiracies spread. Was he set up by politicians? Framed by police? Silenced by those threatened by his cultural power? But beneath the mythos, a real man sat in a real cell. A man who had risen from zinc-roofed ghetto life to musical immortality, only to be shackled by a system that once broadcast his voice, now sought to bury it. He once said in an interview, "Jamaica is afraid of Vybz Kartel because Vybz Kartel is not afraid of Jamaica." Now, behind bars, the world was left to ask, was this justice? Or was it revenge disguised as law? Prison was supposed to be the end. For most artists, a life sentence would mean silence, the kind that buries voices, careers, and legacies. But Vybz Kartel defied that logic. In fact, from behind bars, he became something even more dangerous than a free man with a mic. A myth with a message, caged, yet louder than ever. After his 2014 conviction, Kartel was moved to the Tower Street Adult Correctional Center, also known as GP, or General Penitentiary, one of Jamaica's oldest and harshest prisons. Surrounded by concrete, iron, and watchful eyes, many expected him to fade from musical relevance. Instead, he did the opposite. He evolved. Between 2014 and 2020, Cartel released a shocking number of songs. Dozens upon dozens, more than most free artists in the genre. Tracks like Fever, Infrared, Real Youth, Thank You Ja, Western Union, and Luxury Doll flowed to the streets, flooding YouTube, Spotify, and clubs across the Caribbean. His fan base only grew. The question everyone asked, how? Authorities denied that Cartel had access to recording equipment. Prison officials insisted the music was all pre-recorded. But the consistency, relevance, and lyrical evolution of the tracks suggested otherwise. Some verses directly reference current events, hinting that Cartel was still creating, somehow, in real time. Rumors swirled. Some believed he was secretly recording vocals through contraband cell phones. Others claimed he bribed prison guards. A few theorized that Cartel had a mobile studio disguised as a book cart. One theory even suggested he used coded voice notes, smuggled out and polished by producers. Nothing was ever confirmed, but the output spoke for itself. What's more incredible was the quality of the work. Tracks like Fever didn't just chart locally, they exploded internationally. The song topped various iTunes reggae charts and made its way into clubs across North America, the UK, and Africa. His 2016 album, King of the Dance Hall, was a critical and commercial success. Even Billboard took notice. And yet, he remained confined to a small prison cell. But Cartel wasn't just releasing music. He was reinventing his image. The once controversial badman was now writing songs that were more introspective, spiritual, and socially aware. Thank You Ja was a gospel-tinged meditation. Real Youth was a reflection on betrayal. He remained sexual, streetwise, and savage, but a new dimension was forming. A dimension shaped by time, pressure, and introspection. In interviews smuggled out via letters or through intermediaries, Cartel maintained his innocence and claimed he was being politically persecuted. He began to speak more about spirituality, injustice, and resilience. He compared himself to Mandela, Tupac, even Marcus Garvey. In 2021, a documentary clip from Fox 5 New York sent shockwaves through Jamaica. In it, Cartel appeared on video from his prison cell, his face visibly thinner, but his eyes still intense. He spoke with clarity, confidence, and conviction. My music will never stop. I've always been the voice of the ghetto. Prison doesn't change that. If anything, it proves it. Behind bars, Cartel had become more than a DJ. He was now a symbol of resistance, brilliance, and systemic injustice. He represented the ghetto youth who were told they'd never be enough. The rebel intellect who couldn't be controlled. The creative genius who turned punishment into poetry. His music became protest. His silence became volume. And while his body remained behind walls, his influence seeped through them, into speakers, headphones, playlists, and minds across the diaspora. Some called it a miracle. Others, a manipulation. But for millions, one thing was undeniable. Vibes Cartel was proof that you can cage the man, but not the voice. Behind the bleached skin, the tattoos, the headlines, and the prison bars, there was a man, a father, a lover, a son, and a poet who, in the rare privacy of his confinement, still wrote letters, not lyrics, to the people who held pieces of his heart. The world knew Vibes Cartel, the icon who revolutionized dancehall. But Adija Azeem Palmer, the man, remained an enigma. From the very beginning, Cartel had been deeply tied to his roots, not just musically but personally. He kept his inner circle tight. Even as fame brought more eyes and temptations, he remained in close contact with his family, particularly his mother Teresa Palmer, a devout Christian who had raised him with strict values. In rare interviews, Cartel spoke fondly of her, calling her the anchor that kept him sane amidst chaos. But perhaps the most complex layer of his personal life was his role as a father. Cartel has 7 children, including sons who would later enter the music business themselves. His most well-known son, Lickle Vibes, began releasing tracks under the Gaza Nation banner alongside his brother Lickle Addy. From behind prison walls, Cartel continued to mentor them, reviewing lyrics, suggesting improvements, even guiding business decisions. He once wrote, "Me haffi teach dem fi navigate a world dat tried fi bury me voice. De same one dat praise me one day, den persecute me de next." Letters to his children were often filled with pride, instructions, and warnings. He told them to study, to observe carefully, and never to let fame compromise their integrity. For all the violent and controversial lyrics he penned, his messages to his children were full of tenderness and caution. Then there was Tanisha Shorty Johnson, the woman widely recognized as Cartel's longtime partner and the mother of several of his children. Their relationship was a storm of loyalty, betrayal rumors, breakups, and reconciliations, the kind of emotional volatility that fueled songs like Come Home, Love You Anew, and Thank You Mama. Despite moments of public drama, including voice notes allegedly showing fights and separation, Shorty remained a central figure in Cartel's life. She managed his business affairs after his incarceration, maintained contact with his attorneys, and kept Gaza Empire's vision alive. In private notes, Cartel reportedly referred to her as his warrior queen, a title reflecting not just romance, but partnership in a kingdom under siege. But prison solitude forced reflection. In interviews conducted via letters and restricted phone calls, Cartel spoke more frequently about loyalty, who remained true, and who used his downfall as an exit strategy. Some protégés drifted away. Some associates betrayed his trust. Others, like Popcon, soared into global superstardom, yet distanced themselves from the original Gaza structure. It stung. Yet Cartel never responded with venom, at least not publicly. He seemed to understand the nature of survival in the music industry. But in songs like Betray de Gaza, the pain came through. Lyrics laced with regret, coded messages, and longing for brotherhood lost. Still, amidst betrayal, he also found renewed loyalty in unexpected places. Fans across Africa, Europe, and the US began organizing campaigns, raising legal funds, and circulating petitions. Letters from supporters poured in weekly. Some were from Jamaican ghetto youth who saw in him a reflection of their own pain. Others were from PhDs, legal experts, and even pastors who, despite not endorsing his lyrics, respected his intellect and saw a bigger picture. Over time, the image of Vibes Cartel morphed. No longer just the bleach-skinned badman with a machine gun flow, he had become a complex cultural figure, someone who embodied both the genius and the burden of Black Caribbean manhood. He once wrote, "I'm the villain because I refuse to be the victim." That refusal, to be erased, to be forgotten, to be muted, is what kept his voice alive. And through love, loyalty, and letters, the man behind the myth remained unbroken. Injustice doesn't end with a verdict, and for Vibes Cartel, the fight was never about one trial. It was about a system he believed was built to silence men like him, outspoken, brilliant, and unafraid to challenge the establishment. If prison had become his battleground, then the courtroom would become his front line. Cartel's legal team wasted no time. In the months following his 2014 conviction, his attorneys began building a case for appeal. Their argument was layered and damning, alleging not just flaws in procedure, but a total breakdown of due process. They cited tainted digital evidence, jury misconduct, witness intimidation, and judicial bias. Central to their appeal was the phone evidence. The prosecution had relied heavily on BlackBerry Messenger texts and audio recordings allegedly recovered from Cartel's smartphone. But his defense team insisted the metadata showed post-seizure activity, suggesting tampering. They raised alarms that files had been modified while the device was in police custody, a serious breach of forensic protocol. Even more disturbing was the revelation in 2014 that a juror had allegedly attempted to bribe others during deliberation. This resulted in that juror being arrested and later sentenced to 12 months in prison. For Cartel's team, it was clear the trial had been compromised from the inside out. Yet, the Jamaican Court of Appeal moved slowly. For years, Cartel and his co-defendants remained in prison awaiting judgment. Fans watched with increasing frustration, but Cartel remained calm, even optimistic. In 2017, he told Fox 5 New York via an exclusive prison interview, "I've been through hell, but I'm still here. And when I get out, the world better prepare." Then in April 2020, a glimmer of hope. The Jamaican Court of Appeal reduced his parole eligibility from 35 years to 32 and a half, but upheld the conviction. The news sent shockwaves through the diaspora. Disappointment, rage, and confusion followed. How could such glaring legal issues not result in acquittal? But Cartel's legal team wasn't done. In 2022, they took the case to the Privy Council in the United Kingdom, Jamaica's final court of appeal. The move was historic. Few cases made it that far. Fewer still captured global attention the way this one did. In March 2024, the UK Privy Council made a landmark ruling. Vibes Cartel's murder conviction was quashed. The ruling was not an exoneration of guilt, but a powerful indictment of how the trial was conducted. The court found that the jury misconduct, especially the presence of a bribed juror, rendered the entire verdict unsafe. It ruled that due process had not been followed, and the conviction could not stand. Jamaica erupted. Gaza flags waved again in the streets. Fans cried in the streets of Kingston and Portmore. Online petitions for his immediate release trended globally. But the victory was bittersweet. Despite the ruling, Cartel remained imprisoned as Jamaican prosecutors announced their intention to retry the case. The celebration turned back into protest. Legal analysts questioned the ethics of retrying a man who had already spent over a decade behind bars, whose health had deteriorated, and whose case had become a global symbol of cultural injustice. Human rights organizations, including UN-affiliated legal groups, began monitoring the case. They cited inhumane prison conditions, health violations, and unusual delays in releasing a man whose conviction had been overturned. Cartel's legal team filed urgent medical petitions, revealing that he suffered from a serious heart condition, worsened by solitary confinement and lack of adequate health care. Still, he remained focused. In a written message shared through his attorneys, he said, "The voice they tried to silence only got louder. Every bar, every verse I've ever written, it was for this moment." As of 2025, Vibes Cartel remains in custody. His legal team continues to press for either his immediate release or a dismissal of the case due to constitutional violations. The Jamaican public remains split. Some still call for accountability, others for freedom. But no one can deny his cultural impact. Because Cartel's story is no longer just his own. It's the story of a system versus a sound, a courtroom versus a culture, a country versus its most controversial son. Whether you see him as a prophet or a poison, a genius or a gangster, Vibes Cartel cannot be ignored. Adija Palmer was never meant to be ordinary. From the dusty lanes of Portmore to the global stage of digital streaming, he defied every prediction. He emerged from poverty not with a plea for help, but a pen in hand, one that carved lyrics sharp enough to pierce the soul of a nation. He revolutionized dancehall, not by imitating the past, but by challenging it, fusing street language with academic brilliance, transforming taboo into art, and pushing boundaries until they cracked. Where others saw limits, he saw launchpads. His life reads like a Greek tragedy and a Jamaican ghetto ballad in equal measure, filled with rise and ruin, loyalty and betrayal, brilliance and blood. But what makes Cartel different from the dozens of dancehall stars who came before him is not just his catalog or controversy. It's the fact that, even in complete confinement, his voice never dimmed. He reshaped what it means to be incarcerated in the digital age, turning concrete walls into echo chambers and a prison cell into a recording booth of resistance. Cartel gave birth to a cultural nation, Gaza, that still lives, breathes, and shapes the identities of millions across the Caribbean and diaspora. He created global superstars, changed fashion trends, broke linguistic norms, and exposed the uncomfortable truths about class, power, and justice in Jamaica. He may never walk free again, or he may emerge to reclaim the mic once more. But either way, the story of Vibes Cartel is far from over. His lyrics still pulse through the speakers of the Caribbean. His face still graces murals in the ghettos. His name still sparks debate in parliaments and schoolyards alike. He is not a man. He is a movement. And no matter what the system tries, you cannot silence a voice that gave the voiceless a sound.